This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Pot liquor is the rich, savory liquid left in the pot after boiling collard greens. This distilled fluid was once salvage food that was vital nectar for enslaved people in the American South. In the 20th century, it became a staple in many Southern dishes, and more recently, it's become vogue. Pot liquor is just one of the many Southern foods that reflect a larger story about the South, a story of social upheaval, multiculturalism, and gentrification. And it's featured in a new book by John T. Edge. John T.'s been gathering anecdotes about Southern food and social action for decades. He's a contributing editor at Garden and Gun, a columnist for the Oxford American, and also directs the Southern Foodways Alliance. John T. will talk about the new book, The Potlicker Papers, at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight. But first, he joins me in the studio. Welcome, John T.
Thank you, sir.
Good to have you here. You've been interested in Southern food for a long time. Grew up in rural Georgia.
I did.
And ended up at the University of Mississippi writing a master's thesis on corn pone and pot liquor.
I did.
Well, tell us more about that.
This was a debate in 1931 between Huey Long, who at that point was senator-elect from Louisiana, and Julian Harris, who's the son of Joel Chandler Harris, the interpreter of the Uncle Remus tales. And in 1931, during the Depression, at a moment when prohibition was the rule of the land, they wanted for a diversion, and they got it in debating the relative merits of dunking or crumbling cornbread into pot liquor. And what interested me, though, was that as people wrote in letters to the editor, to the Atlanta paper about this, they talked about pot liquor and they talked about cornbread. But what they really talked about were issues of race and racism, of class difference, of gender inequities, all those things that still embroil us today. And food offers us a way then, and it offers us a way now to think about those issues.
How were those issues embedded in that seemingly frivolous debate over whether to dunk or crumble?
So women wrote in and said, well, it's fine for you boys to talk about the relative merits of dunking or crumbling, but I'm a modern woman focused on my career. I'm a modern woman who's escaping the kitchen. How dare you try to put me back in the kitchen? I'm stepping out.
And pot liquor itself, tell us more about it, because it does have a rich history and it's a fascinating story about kind of the amount of nutrition that's contained in this stuff, right?
And it's one of the subversive things about pot liquor. You know, as you mentioned, you know, pot liquor is the distilled essence of a pot of greens or beans, often referred to that way, too. But as those greens or beans cook, especially the greens, the nutrients leach out so that the nutrients remain at the bottom of the pot in the liquor. And during the enslavement period, the masters, slave masters, would take those greens thinking that was the prize and leave the liquor in the bottom of the pot. And in fact, the nutrients resided in the bottom of the pot. So there's a subversiveness in that knowledge now today in regard.
And folks came to love it, too. I mean, the fact that it's got a name. I mean, it wasn't something that you threw out. It got itself a name. People knew what it was and came to revere it. And again, as you say, it was a vital substance in those days. You open your book on Southern food at the scene of the Montgomery bus boycotts. Yeah. Now tell us about the relationship between food and that incredibly important moment.
The character who opens my book is Georgia Gilmore. And Georgia Gilmore was a midwife. Georgia Gilmore had laid track on the railroad in Montgomery, Alabama. And Georgia Gilmore was a cook. And as the Montgomery bus boycotts begin in 1955, she comes to the very first meeting of the Montgomery Improvement Association. When Dr. King takes the charge, when Rosa Parks steps to the stage after she refused to step to the back of the bus, Georgia Gilmore shows up at that very first mass meeting with a hamper full of fried chicken and white bread. And she recognizes that if they're going to set up an alternate transportation system, if you're going to quit the white segregated city buses and you're going to run church station wagons and family sedans, they're going to need gas. They're going to need new brakes after a while. And she, by way of her cooking and by way of a group of friends she called the Club from Nowhere, both literally and figuratively fuel the movement.
And they understood this. I mean, you get the idea that any kind of a movement, and this is sadly what's missing today in any kind of a resistance movement, is this kind of deep planning and organization. we're going to need food if this thing lasts for a long time. We're going to need organization, transportation. We're going to need to prepare for the people who are going to be hurt by this protest. And, of course, they understood that intuitively because they'd been doing it for generations, right?
There are many lessons that the civil rights movement offers us when we think about food that are resonant today if we just look back then and not believe that our solutions are epiphanies we have in the 2010s.
So tell us more. So what kind of food did Georgia Gilmore serve?
Georgia Gilmore served fried chicken, fried pork chops. Dr. King was a special fan of her pork chops. She served roni and rice, macaroni and rice. She served the working class foods of black and white Southerners. She served them with aplomb, and she served them with kind of a great presence. She didn't suffer fools.
And interestingly enough, not only did she serve the folks who were going to need this as part of their to sustain a movement, but she also sold it. I mean, this was a way to also finance the movement, right?
She testified when the city of Montgomery attempted to declare the bus boycotts illegal. She testified in that trial in defense of Dr. King and the Montgomery Improvement Association, and was either dismissed from her job or had to leave her job because of the pressure. And she set up a home restaurant. You know, today when we're exploring Cuba, everyone's excited to go to Cuba to eat in paladares, which are home restaurants in Cuba. African-American Southerners of that moment established home restaurants, too. And they were places to build black wealth away from the white gaze. They were also places to build community and resistance and plan strategies.
So race and identity certainly all tied up in Southern food, but it's also, we have to remember, talking about diet and nutrition, and you focus on that in your book, too. And the amount of starvation and malnutrition in the Mississippi Delta in the 1960s.
Yeah. I mean, the Mississippi Delta is where America discovered the problems in its midst. And one of the problems that the Delta offered in stark reality, photographs by Al Clayton, who traveled the American South documenting this, open a chapter in my book. The Mississippi Delta is a place that Robert F. Kennedy kind of has his epiphany. He glimpses poverty in the shacks of the Mississippi Delta and comes away aghast and determined to make change. So the Mississippi Delta and the South kind of writ larger is a place that America has long identified its problems. What I take pains to explain in the book is it's also a place where Southerners have incubated solutions as well, bold solutions oftentimes.
Bold solutions to a problem that should never have existed, because the great pain and the indictment here is the irony that the Mississippi Delta is one of the most fertile places on earth. There should be plenty of food for everybody there. People are starving.
People are starving because the Delta is put to use in service of pocketbooks and not in service of people. But one of these bold solutions that I admire the most that comes out of this moment in the mid to late 1960s is the Tufts Delta Health Clinic. And Jack Geiger, who had been a Freedom Summer 1964 volunteer in the Mississippi Delta, had studied in South Africa and became enamored of, inspired by community health clinics there. Geiger recognized that the way to address hunger and the way to address the ills of poverty and what that did to the working class folk of the Mississippi Delta and broader was to prescribe food.
I mean, there was a clinic set up, right?
Yep.
And Dr. Geiger recognizes that, oh my goodness, people are starving here.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to prescribe food.
Yeah.
And explains why. You have an episode called a podcast called Gravy.
Yes.
And you recount that story. And here he explains why it had to be a prescription, because it would the complications of getting food and first explaining the importance of food and diet and nutrition, but sort of the cleverness in using the prescription pad as a way to solve this basic problem.
When there was this kind of crisis in a family, usually with a sick infant, but we also knew with two or three other children, very often in the family, likely with marginal malnutrition, and we knew that no mother was going to feed if we provided for just the one child and let the others sit there and watch. That was an impossibility. So we decided whenever we saw this kind of crisis situation, we would write prescriptions for food for all of the children, the mother as well, for usually a period of 2 weeks, the duration of the acute illness.
A clip from the podcast Gravy, produced by Southern Foodways Alliance, and I'm here with the podcast host, John T. Edge, who's authored a new book, The Potlicker Papers. He's going to be reading from that book. You can find out the information at our website, stateofthings.org. So how is that paid for? You got the prescription, but the problem is, I guess, paying for it, right?
Right. So he got Office of Equal Opportunity money, federal money, and basically argued his case by way of turning to the medical textbooks and says, when you look in the textbook, the specific treatment for hunger is food. And so he used federal grants and built a system that endures today. The problem, from my perspective, is that we now look upon food prescription programs, and a great organization like Wholesome Wave does that today, but we don't link that bold moment today to that bold moment past. And there's this yawning gap between the two.
You also, in your book, you humanize this too and talk about sort of other aspects of food in the American South, the story of Colonel Sanders and the story behind Kentucky Fried Chicken and how that empire grew is a fascinating tale.
It's fascinating to me, too. I think we have a tendency to think about fast food as something that's been visited upon the South, that arrived by way of Ray Kroc and McDonald's. And yet, you look at the story of Colonel Sanders, who begins his business in Corbin, Kentucky, who takes a hyper-traditional Southern food, fried chicken, and modernizes it by way of pressure cooking, by way of serving that fried chicken in pasteboard boxes or tubs. He's taking this hyper-traditional good, repackaging it for a modern South and selling it back to the South. It's not a subversion of the South. It's a reflection of a modernizing, urbanizing, and ultimately suburbanizing South.
But you talk about the second thoughts he had as the product itself became a kind of an industrial corporate product that so much of our fast food is.
Sanders was a major league cursor. He was a man expert at profanity. And you recognize in these statements that he made after he'd sold Kentucky Fried Chicken as it began to expand. He referred to the fried chicken as a damn dough ball stuck on top of a chicken leg. Like, he recognized, I believe, his own complicity in the kind of subversion of these traditions. And I'm not saying that he's prescient about the dietary impact, but it rankled him. You can see it in his statements that he was a part of the end of this thing in many ways that he nurtured.
What does it say about the way in which Southern food is sort of in all of our imaginations, that something that started out as a kind of a regional franchise really became an important national franchise? In other words, the rest of the country really embraced this quintessential Southern food.
I mean, the rest of the country has long embraced so many Southern cultural outputs, whether that's jazz music or bluegrass. You know, this nation has long found fascination with the queer regional culture that we are. You know, I'm not saying we are, but that's the perspective on this place. They come looking for a more naive America, come looking for a more traditionalist America. And in many ways, we as Southerners serve that up to them. We trade in mythos and tales that are not necessarily always driven by fact.
Well, and one of the myths, certainly, that Colonel Sanders himself as a personage and as an icon embodied was a certain version of the South, and that was the white version of the South.
Yeah.
The gospel singer Mahalia Jackson opened a fried chicken franchise called Glory Fried Chicken as well, right?
Yeah, so it's called Mahalia Jackson's Fried Chicken Systems. And along with veterans of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, she founded this fried chicken franchise. And they talked about this being a business relationship, not a plantation ship. It was an attempt to leverage white dollars along with black dollars and build black jobs, build black wealth. Fried chicken at that point, inspired by Sanders, who'd been so incredibly wealthy, it was a path to economic surety, was a path to success. And that's what Mahalia Jackson's fried chicken system sold, was that promise.
And there was a kind of a segregated versions of Southern cooking. I mean, Southern cooking was associated with white cooking, and then if the same food, if it served in African-American communities or in that context, became soul food, right?
Well, this happens, this kind of segregation of those two foods happens in the late 1960s, at the same time when you hear the term soul power and soul music. It is a definition by African-Americans, a politicized definition of this is our food and that's yours over there. In that same moment, though, you hear riffs on this. Dick Gregory, the activist, begins arguing for a vegetarian or a vegan or a fruitarian diet, you know, and asks for soil food, not soul food. It gets complicated.
So these days, it's complicated even further by in the first place, the kind of gentrification of Southern mm-hmm. food, right? It's
right.
become kind of vogue and precious. What do you make of that?
I mean, there's new value established for our cultural products, for our region as a whole. As we gain distance between the lunge of Bull Connor's police dogs in the 1960s, Southerners begin to experience kind of a rekindled patriotism, a belief, you know, begins in the Carter Ascent in 1976. All that builds. And what we end up with, new value applied to our cultural products. And one of the most profound cultural products to emerge from this place is our food culture. You see white, mainly men, chefs step to the fore. That's what happens when things get valuable.
Yes,
white men step to the fore.
And quintupling the price of collard greens, which are pretty plentiful.
But it's an interesting negotiation there, because I think about a restaurant like Crook's Corner, which opened in 1982 and, you know, in Chapel Hill. Yes, Crook's was a part of the gentrification of Southern food. It also was this kind of bohemian space that gestated a creative class mm-hmm. in Chapel Hill, too.
These days, it's not just the traditional Southern foods, but a lot of international foods, particularly Latin America, that's making its way into Southern cooking.
Yeah, and I embrace that. I mean, so many people talk to me about Southern food, and they want to ground Southern food in some past. And I talk to them about the idea that culture is a process and not a product, and that a future tense Southern food is now in the making. I saw Cecilia Polanco last night, who has a beautiful, beautiful pupusa business that she began as a University of North Carolina student. I see her as very much a part of a future tense South in gestation, wherein we gain much, we as Southerners, I use that term broadly, we don't lose a darn thing.
Is it catching on? Is there a kind of fusion movement where these pupusas are sort of collard green and barbecue? Or
yeah, I mean, you know, that term fusion, I think, is almost pejorative. I'm not saying you use it that way, but when people hear that, they often mm-hmm. think about uneasy marriages. I think there are very natural marriages of collards and pupusas on the horizon, yeah.
Good stuff. So, and what do you see happening in North Carolina? North Carolina, obviously, one of the states where there's the greatest influx and migration. I don't know if that'll continue, but is this kind of ground zero for some of that? Or
I think it is. I mean, you see this kind of Latinization of the South. We are, the Southern Foodways Alliance, are staging our summer symposium in Charlotte this year, a city that has certainly been impacted by construction industry, job growth, and the like. I think that North Carolina, we will find a time in the not too distant future when the mom and pops are going to be as much about Laotian mom and pops and Vietnamese owned mom and pops and Mexican American owned mom and pops as the way we may have defined it in the past. And I grew up in a time in Mississippi when my son, you know, tacos al pastor are his barbecue sandwiches.
Great stuff. John T. Edge, James Beard Award winning writer, director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, and author of the new book, The Potlicker Papers. John T. will be reading tonight from his book at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill, 7 o'clock. You can get the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Thanks so much, John T.
Thank you, Frank.
Just ahead, we'll talk about a new memoir about growing up with a Catholic priest for a father. Stay with us.